This is Rod Allen.
And I'm John Maeda.
And this is Free Range Humans, a place where we consider how to make schools fit for human consumption. And as always, we're joined by Gino Beniamino, our amazing producer. We are joined today by Jessica Risch and Malaika Boyer, who are principal and sixth grade teacher at Santa Monica Alternative Schoolhouse. Joel, you visited SMASH. What a great name for a school, by the way. And I know you came back completely excited, really pumped by what you saw.
I did. Yeah, Libby and I are traveling for our Human Schools project book, and we had an opportunity to spend a day at SMASH, and I was just totally wowed and couldn't wait to have Jessica and Malaika on. So Jessica and Malaika, welcome.
Thank you.
Jessica, why don't you tell us a little bit about the purpose and mission of the school?
Sure. So SMASH started 52 years ago in 1973, grassroots effort by a group of parents, and has always had the same philosophy, practices, and mission, although things iterate over time. But it was started as a public school of choice where nurturing active citizens in an ever-evolving democracy was the heart of what it was about, with a equal value to social-emotional curriculum as to anything academic.
Great. And Malaika, why did you come to SMASH?
I came to SMASH in another position initially, and it was a strange school that I didn't understand. This was 18 years ago. And then when I did figure out what SMASH stood for, I ended up staying because I knew that we raise our children with lots of care, lots of love. We do academics, but we also do the whole child. So I stayed for that.
How has SMASH iterated over time, Jessica, in your mind? Like, what sorts of ebbs and flows have you seen?
Well, some are more like concrete technical and some are more about a feeling and an experience. So concrete technical, everything has always been multi-age. We believe so strongly that you deserve to have the chance to be the younger child in the family, the middle child in the family, the elder in the family. The way those age groups have been configured, we've played around with over time. But no matter what, it is always multi-age. But at one point we were K1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Those age groupings have been played around with over time. Some other changes have been, let's see, this is my 29th year with SMASH, but my 17th year as a principal because I used to teach here. So at some point, probably around 17, 18 years ago, straddling right before I was principal and when I became principal, we decided that we were going to all get trained in a social-emotional curriculum to have a similarity in language and process, even though we had always been really committed to creating embedded social-emotional experiences throughout the day. We've held strong to that SEL, which we loved meeting with Libby because she was one of the host teachers at that school that created that. Other changes?
I think that we are able to do more because we've been doing it longer. So maybe in the district or maybe in other schools in the last 10 or 15 years, PBL became a popular term, project-based learning. Maybe social-emotional learning as well as academics became like a popular idea. But for us, by that time, we were already refining it. We were experts in it, and it has changed because we've just gotten more mastery of all of that.
So related to that, we went through a year of working with people who did energy medicine, Tai Chi, yoga instructors, mindfulness instructors to build our own adult practices that then we could take in with our students. We didn't start with that when we were creating our circle work or any of that.
It's always interesting to see how, like, when you were sort of PBL before there was PBL and those kinds of things, it's really interesting to see how things, morph over time.
So one of the distinctive structures of your school is that students are in what I might call sort of like grade bands. I don't know the exact names for this, but the first graders are the mentors and the kindergartners are the apprentices. And then when you get to second grade, you're like an apprentice again, and the third graders are the mentors. And I'd never really seen, you know, there are schools where the teachers loop, but I'd never really sort of seen this idea that, you know, kids could be given roles and that those roles would sort of shift from being the bigger kid to being the littler kid again. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Where did it come from? What does it do for your students?
Well, Jessica, he's referring to his conversation with one of our core one teachers, in which you described that process as an evolutionary continuum, you know, all the way to ACT.
So yes, kindergartners are partners. First graders are bigs. Second graders are apprentices. Third graders are mentors. And so not only do you take on each role while you have a 2-year experience with we say teaching marriages, like the teaching team of the credentialed teachers and the instructional assistants are really a marriage, a work marriage. So the students get to be raised in that family with the same adults for 2 years, but they get to have different roles. And remember, that also means they're staggering what students in the school they're immersed in. So 1 year with the group sort of below you, and then you're going to loop up to the next core and you're going to find your friends that you used to be with when you were in that multi-age core previously. Did we say that in a way that makes sense?
I think so. So that's the sort of structure of what's happening. What do you think that does for the kids?
Oh, permission to truly be who you are and where you're at, because everybody has relative strengths and relative areas that they're growing. And so when you're deeply well known over time and there's a bigger age span in the room where you're at, there's more permission to truly be who you are and where you're at in each of those things throughout the day. I also think it adds to the ethos that you're also going to connect with students beyond who's in your core, because this sense of that we mix and mingle and are known for different ages and relationships. So you'll see, hopefully you saw when you were here, middle schoolers being greeted as like with great enthusiasm by little ones and thinking back with fondness to the evolution they went through, right? And so then they're supporting students that way.
Yeah. And I also think too, it mirrors the relationship that we as teachers or staff have with students, because it sort of says that, I think I mentioned this to you before, Jal, that we're all learners, right? Yes, we're experts, we're teachers, yes. And also we're learners. So if we can learn from youngers and they can learn from us, then we could have that same setup with our students, learning from youngers and being a teacher themselves.
Another benefit to having these various roles. So Malika's teaching in 6th, 7th, 8th grade, right? That's the only place where we have a 3-year span right now. And 6th graders know their year-long passion projects are going to be the first iteration, but they get to see what 7th and 8th graders do when they have that significant time each week to follow their curiosity and be working with mentors and
get feedback from them.
Yeah.
Joel, what struck you about that when you saw that in action?
I think it's a really good structure. I think one of the goals of what we're trying to do in school is get away from each kid as an individual sort of striver and like how far and how fast can I go? And I think that this structure sort of just brings out a different side of kids, that never are kids better than when they are taking care of younger kids and kids look up to older kids. And it's just like a really nice sort of side of people that we sort of deny in school a lot of the time by just putting them with their same age peers and being like, you know, you got a 96 and you got a 94 and you got an 84. Like, it's just sort of like, how do we help the kids see themselves? And this is just sort of a different way of seeing themselves. And before you asked me, I was going to push it right back to you. You've been around a lot of schools over the years, and as a superintendent, you had an opportunity to restructure some things. What do you think about the sort of cross-age grouping idea?
I think it's super important. Like we said earlier on, it sort of mirrors what a family is like. Families are multi-age and they take care of one another and all those things. It sort of mirrors that far more natural kind of structure. I was principal at an elementary school that was kindergarten to grade 7. And over a weekend, we reshifted all the classrooms. All the staff came in and we just moved everything around. So instead of starting at kindergarten at one end of it, was sort of a big circular school, you know, kindergarten and going around the circle and ending up at grade 7, we intermingled. So we had grade 7s and then we had kindergartens and then we had, you know, grade 3s. And then we just shuffled the deck and parents lost their minds on Monday, which was kind of fun. Because the, you know, the grade 7s were going to knock over little kids in the halls and all that stuff. And what did we see? We saw at recess time, the grade 7s helping the little kids put their boots and coats on to go outside for recess. We saw behavior just calm in the, you know, older kids end of the school. Because kids are naturally loving, caring humans. And they took care of one another. So I just love the idea. I'm always wondering, though, why it seems like it's a novelty instead of just how we do business. Like, why is that seemingly unusual? It seems like a no-brainer to me.
I have two things to add to what you both just said. One, Smash isn't new. We're 52 years old. And even in our own Santa Monica, greater LA community, this isn't a practice. Mm-hmm. Even when your neighbors are seeing and feeling, it still doesn't seem to spread. So I don't know the answer to your question, Rod, but I'm agreeing, even when you're in close proximity and are modeling it over time, I don't know why it doesn't spread. And then the other piece, Jal, when you were speaking, there's also something about the younger enthusiasm, like contagious enthusiasm, that also benefits the older students in each core around the school. Like, permission to not filter your curiosity and exuberance and your, definitely to your point, Rod, having the sort of the family feel and the multi-generations in a space together, it does temper it softens the edges of some of the like risk-taking or adolescence, because they're very much in touch with all these relationships with students and staff who have raised them.
One of the other things that we noticed was how teachers changed as well. So it wasn't just sort of kids. It was when we did that, teachers who maybe were a grade 1 teacher and didn't like working with the big kids because they're, you know, they're bigger and scarier, and because they were now next door or helping the little kids put their boots on or whatever it might be, the teacher relationships across the board with kids shifted a bit. It became more, we're all responsible for all the kids, and teachers weren't going up to another teacher and saying, one of your students at lunchtime did this, you know, you need to deal with it. It's teachers were sort of working with the kids in front of them, and it sort of changed the general dynamic. How has your model, how do you think that impact or feel that impacts the teacher relationships?
We always say like the balcony view. I feel like every teacher, when we say teacher, we mean like person.
Adult.
Yeah.
Human.
How we are raising all the children together.
I think the best way to explain it from my perspective is to talk about the slideshow that I put together at the end of the school year during our open house share for sixth grade. And in it, there were about 217 pictures, and I'm going to say that 50% of those were moments I captured with a student and a staff member, right? Whether it was our custodial staff playing a quick game of pickup basketball with the boys at lunch, you know, whether it was another teacher, we call him the student whisperer, you know, bending down to talk to some students who were not his. I think for me, when I went through that slideshow, I thought, look at this. This is so natural that it doesn't matter who the adult is. they have a relationship and can speak about that child. And we collectively feel like we are raising these amazing human beings.
I love that.
Smash has always been first name. I'm Jessica.
I'm Malaika.
Yeah. I think the expectation is that we have mutually respectful relationships, not because it's like age or hierarchy, but because we're human beings and everybody has triggers and we need to learn each other's triggers and respect that people have different needs. And so part of everyone on this campus, we're making sure we really know each other and try not to trigger you out of respect for who you are and what you need. But then also, when you've flipped your lid and you've reacted in a way that really lands with impact to someone else, whether you're an adult or your kid, that you're thinking about, what do I need to do to go cool off and show when I'm ready to come back and work through it? And I think that because adults model and show, I wish I had paused and I want to rewind. Let me go reset and I'll come back. That I think kids feel safe and cared for.
Yeah.
With my kids especially, I'm always like calm and collected, like 24/7.
Oh, are you?
Never is there a moment where I need to step back and be like, oh, I didn't mean to say that and so forth. So it's probably just your school. I'm like, go ahead.
I can remember that when I first started to do that process of, like Jessica said, coming back after stepping away, even apologizing for something I might have, a misstep, the kids that year, this is many years ago, were so shocked. They said, we have never heard a teacher apologize. And to me, that was like an indication that this is something that benefited the kids and we needed to keep it going. So, you know, own up, make amends, make a repair, whether you're a student or an adult.
I thought I was going to just offer on Jessica's point about it's been 52 years. I mean, Rod and I have talked about this on the pod before, but I think it's more like modern age-graded school is only 125 years old. So before that, we had one-room schoolhouses. And before that, we had, you know, just learning in your family and your community. And so if we go back that far, then the sort of normal, natural way of doing things is more like what you're describing, right? People interacting across age in the context of tasks that needed to be done and in relationships that sort of feels more like a family. And so what I found distinctive about Smash was sort of trying to recreate that family atmosphere in a school. And you all use the language of family. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about what you do to try to kind of cultivate that ethos.
What contributes to a family feel?
We've got all core teams. You've got family groups. Do you want to explain some of that?
Okay. When you come into the school, when you're incoming as a partner, as a kindergartner, even in the summer, we do a series of summer park playdates that are open for returning and incoming families for that core to come play together at the park with the teachers and me. And that is to create this sense of like comfort and play, and there's no yard rules. We're not on campus. It's not district yard rules. We look and see who's gravitating to who, so that the day before school starts, you come and you get matched up with who's going to be your big. And those are family groups. And that big is going to show you like where the water fountain is, where the bathroom is, where you're going to put your lunch and everything. We have a little ice cream social. Those family groups grow to be a lineage, right? Like multiple generations throughout the school, because even as that big goes into core two, right? Someone's coming in as a partner. So that becomes a heritage group, right? We say family groups. Those family groups across kindergarten through eighth grade do community circles for closing meeting twice a month on Fridays. Like that's how we end the week twice a month. So they still get to come back together and they're doing activities and shares and connecting that way. Those family groups that are part of that all core team, the lineage, also get to do special events together. Like we have a field day or in honor of the eighth graders who are graduating out of that heritage, right? They do a special ritual together, like an appreciation circle for those eighth graders who are moving on.
Yeah.
But I think all of those rituals and traditions contribute to a sense of family.
Yeah. And I remember telling Jao that it is with intentionality, right? That we mindfully kind of figure out how to keep the connection or the lineage across grades going. We intentionally do this. That's how it happens, in my opinion.
I think another piece that got paused during COVID, because we had to be in our own age group bubbles, right? We weren't allowed to mix and match. And now we're growing back into this. But something that's been a part of Smash for a long time is at the end of each project, there is a public share, an exhibition of learning. And we have the students from the other cores also have a time to come and interact and celebrate the. We're pretty process oriented, not just the end result of what the learning is. But I think getting to be excited and support someone else in the school and what they learned and they're exhibiting also creates a sense of connection and family.
Mm-hmm.
All the other things that I think many schools do. I mean, we have all kinds of school-wide community.
Yeah, like a jogathon. Back to school night or multicultural potluck night, right? Those are all the kind of regular installations of connection.
Family dance where parents who are musicians are performing and you'll see all kinds of age groups dancing together. But those things I think we take for granted because those are community gatherings that I think lots of schools do. But of course, those contribute to that connection too.
Yes.
You mentioned eighth grade graduation.
My favorite event of the year.
Where do your kids graduate to, and how do they do in those schools that perhaps are organized differently than yours and have perhaps a bit of a different ethos?
Are you an interested parent, Rod?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, first, you have to know that our eighth grade graduation is completely about honoring each individual and each of them write a 2.5 minute speech. So everybody here is a valedictorian, right? Everybody's going to say something about who they are and how they've grown through their time here or what they are looking forward to or appreciate. So
can I just interrupt and say that's also connection? Because in the speeches, we hear the first day in the first grade and throughout, that's also process.
We just heard 2 days ago, oh, when the tambourine first was shaking and it's time to come in when I was a partner and all those things that they reflect back on. And that, remember, our entire school is listening and watching. So
how many students do you have?
Well, some of them are listening through the live stream in their classrooms because their five-year-old bodies might not be ready to sit through the entire thing, but they still can hear what their eighth grade friends are saying. And currently we have 225 students, but we will be growing over the next several years. So instead of having one group per grade level, even though we don't do grade level, we'll end up with 450 students.
But, you know, to the question, we have notice that when they leave us, they might go to our project-based learning high school, they might go to SAMO, but we notice they stand out there too.
Hmm.
So first you should know, historically, well, the 17 years I've been principal, 85% of our graduates go to the 2600 comprehensive public high school that's in our district. It's called Santa Monica High School. So that's where most of our students go. 6 years ago, a program within Santa Monica High School was created called the Project-Based Learning Pathway, which is you're a SAMO High student, but you also have a team of four teachers for your math, science, English, and history that do like integrated curricular and learning through interest and internship. And then the other 15% either go to West LA area private schools. We always have someone who goes to a charter high school that's like a performing arts oriented. But Malaika's point is how they do when they get to a very different size and culture, they do really well. By the way, we didn't mention, we don't give grades. Kindergarten through eighth grade, but when they go into period by period and getting grades, they do well there. But really what we're looking at is, what did the teachers, leaders of the high school or the people who run the program say? And they say our students ask clarifying questions. They won't sit in their confusion, that they have this predisposition to assume that they're going to have positive mentoring relationships with adults, so that even if it hasn't yet been set up, that they seek them out to create that, or that they really want to be active and they take on leadership positions. Mm-hmm. Whether it's sports or student government or visual and performing arts. So back to that mission statement you asked about, like being active citizens in their community, that's how they're known to be.
So, Brad, I have a thought about that, which is, you know, we often ask, okay, so you went to this non-traditional school and you had this education that recognized you as an individual and helped you see the virtues of community and so on and so forth. And then we are like, well, then like they're going to get out into the like cold, hard, terrible world. And like, how are they going to do? When I think maybe we should flip it. A small portion of people, as things stand right now, get the benefit of an environment that sort of all human beings should enjoy, just as, you know, young people who are trying to help develop. And then once they've had that experience, they sort of become carriers. They go out in the world and they're like, well, how come I'm sitting in this, you know, college lecture hall with 600 other kids and no one knows my name? Like, that's not education. What are y'all doing? I think that's good. They become sort of agitators for the next generation. And gradually, you know, once you've experienced that, you can't go back to the same kind of cold transactional thing. Your expectations have been raised. And I think that's healthy. I don't know if you've seen any of those kinds of dynamics in British Columbia.
Absolutely. And it always surprises me that that old story keeps perpetuating. These kids, you know, you got to toughen them up. You got to get them ready. You got to get some scar tissue on them early, which makes absolutely no sense to me at all. And we keep hearing stories, as you've all described, of kids coming out of those, you know, in the district here, Mill Bay Nature School and others that come out of that very nurturing kind of environment, that come out as self-advocates. And they do question and they do excel. I met with a group of parents a few weeks ago whose kids were in Mill Bay Nature School here in the district. And they were questioning about how to advocate for more of that kind of an approach, which is, Jessica and Malika, very similar to what you're describing. They kids would go into clans and as opposed to grades, and they're in those clans over kindergarten through grade eight, some similar structures. And the parents were wondering how to advocate for that. So I said, well, how are your kids doing at high school or at the other schools they've gone into? And they said, oh, they're doing great. They were so well prepared, but that's not the only point. They were happier in this other structure. We're wondering why we don't have sort of this more nurturing kind of thing going on. And it's not about success and preparation as much as about, it's just a better way to do business. And kids seemed happier.
Yeah, you know, to your point, Rod, when I talked with y'all, we talked about how this type of learning can feel experimental, maybe risky. If you feel like your family doesn't have the benefit of what you perceive to be risk-taking, right? That's not necessarily the case at all, but it can feel that way for some who are really accustomed to a very traditional education.
Where's the worksheet in the textbook? I don't think my kid's learning anything unless they see lots of worksheets come home.
That's right.
And the first names, calling the teachers by the first names feels very almost disrespectful, I think, to some parents. Like, you know, is this, you're the adult. Like, why? That's like just not customary in our community or our tradition. How do you handle that?
Well, first, you're both making me smile because I can tell you I'm the one who's there with our students as we give all of the public tours, right? So we gave 12 tours this year with the students with me. And what are the questions we're asked for is, you don't give any homework, kindergarten through fifth grade. It doesn't start till middle school. How are they ready? You don't give grades and test scores until they leave you and go to high school. How are they ready? Absolutely, this question about what kind of disrespect pops up if you're Al first name? And my response for that piece is, you're going to come through all the classrooms now with us. How does it feel to you? What do you notice and how does it feel when kids are greeting me as Jessica? Because to me, any question that they're going to ask me comes from a place of respectful self-advocacy and true curiosity and relationship. They're not using my name in a tone or a way that's disrespectful. Take a look through the classrooms and see how that feels for you. Because I don't know how else to help someone know it. I think it's a feel. And we often say smash like is a feeling.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Malika, how about you?
It's very interesting. I will say this. I was at a school. I took a couple of years away from Smash, left and came back. And at that school, I was Miss Boyer. And I got to say that, unfortunately, I was Miss Boyer, but I also got some stuff stolen from my desk. I was Miss Boyer, but I also had to break up fights. Here I am Malika, and my stuff is safe, and kids are not fighting. So I'm not sure that respect is shown through a name or a title. I think it's in the behavior, in the choices, and in the relationship.
Not to get political, but that would be a great object lesson for some folks. Anyway, sorry, I just had to slip that in.
As you know, I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying. I also feel like there's kind of like a layer of culture building, which is really critical. Like if our listeners tomorrow were like, stop calling me by my last name, start calling me by my first name, maybe that would be the beginning of something really good. But, or, and if it weren't accompanied by, like, I remember a story that Shanna Peoples, who our listeners will know, she was a wonderful teacher from Texas. And she wrote a book about asking questions. And it was about coming into a classroom in seventh grade and really having a miserable year. And then starting the next year with just asking her students some questions and sharing some questions she had about herself. And questions that came up were things like, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? Or why do people get cancer? Or, and Shanna shared some very vulnerable things about herself. And it was sort of the beginning of a very long and positive journey. But anyway, she tells a story in the book of another teacher who read her book or talked to Shanna and just went in and started being vulnerable and asking questions to her students, and her students just destroying her because she hadn't previously built the kind of thing that would hold that. So anyway, maybe people should just start, but I'm also interested in kind of how you build a culture that rewards, or not rewards, but normalizes the kind of respectful self-advocacy you're talking about.
Great question.
I'm not sure if this directly answers that, but this is what comes to mind, and I'd be interested to hear from each of you where you've seen really dynamic examples of culture building. But part of it, I think, is we haven't explored that much yet in this conversation about how truly, truly we have parent partnerships. We know that parents are the best and first teachers of their children, and the amount of intentionality, time, and care we take to really getting to know parents, the language they use, the rituals they use at home, the things that are on their mind as the next best stretch for their child, the things that give them disequilibrium and anxiety for their kids. But I think that's part of culture building, is that kids here really feel like home and school grownups are in it together with them. And I think that might be a piece of what you're asking about, where that culture is built from. Yeah. And that you'll always have any given year some parents who have more disequilibrium, more anxiety of choice around what's happening for their child. So I think part of the culture building is you're co-parenting with a whole cohort, and it's a 9-year journey here. By the way, we get 4-year-olds next year. We're going to have TK, so it's going to be a 10-year journey here. We're thrilled. I think that's also part of culture, is that it's the gift of time that you can not be so steady or understand it right away, but you know you're investing in it for the long haul, and that's through a kid's heart and eyes, that's through a staff member's, that's through a parent's. So I think that's part of culture, is just the longevity of relationship that you're investing in. But what else do you think, Monica?
I actually have to go back to one of my favorite topics, social emotional learning. Because we start that early on, because we go like above and beyond, say, a mandated curriculum, I think therein lies the building of culture. I mean, you can pull from, there's so many models out there, so many. But I think that if you begin sort of working on identity and you begin on working on creating and building a sense of trust, you model from adult to adult communication that is respectful. All of these things lend itself to a strong social emotional learning experience. And I think that is where our culture, for me, at least from my perspective, is greatly built.
A big part of culture is staff or the adults in the building. There's culture with that you're growing with students and creating an environment as new kids come in, bringing them along into the culture and so on. Jessica, you've mentioned a couple of times that you've been principal there for 17 years, which is a crazy number. Like, that's a big number to be a principal in one school, at least up here. People seem to move around a bit more. So that's an example of some longevity in a role. And that's so important for cultural sort of transmission, if you will. How about teacher retention? How about when new teachers come on board and new staff members come on board? What kinds of things do you do to sort of bring them into this ethos? Because they might come in with some different perspectives.
Well, first, I'll make you laugh that at the every other Tuesday principals meetings, they call me well-seasoned.
For a while.
Yeah.
Yes. So
maybe it's your salty language. Just kidding. No, I don't know.
Principal turnover is a thing everywhere. So that's just very good.
But teachers.
Onboarding teachers.
Yeah. Onboarding teachers. I mean, we are lucky because we have teachers who maybe leave after a pregnancy or some family emergency or something. People have been here for decades. We just don't leave smash. But now we are in the unique position of onboarding new staff.
Because we're going to grow to welcome additional students. So it's not that we have turnover, but we're welcoming additional teammates. Yeah.
And so we've had a lot of time to think about how do we, because it's something that we do, but we haven't necessarily named with intentionality. So what are we going to do to continue the culture?
Well, a few things about onboarding. When you have things set up as a work marriage, that means there's someone else who also is there to welcome your new stories and energy and ideas, and also to be the keeper of stories and rituals and things that already are in place to connect with you around. Another piece I would say is we always host and visit. So we do guided learning exchanges with other staffs every year. And that's to keep our own thoughts and possibilities alive, but also to build relationships with people long before we actually have openings. So, you know, it's like, I don't know, is it offensive to say mutually courting each other? but really making sure we know each other for who and how we are and what we're interested in and how we learn together, so that by the time you're actually interviewing when there's an opening, that is so not the first step of getting to know each other. So I think that makes a difference.
That makes a difference. And then there's smaller pieces, so insignificant, you almost would think they don't matter, but they do. For instance, and we should do it here, I'm totally kidding, we end our meetings with shout outs and appreciations. A small thing, right? But it works to build community. So I might say something like, Rod, I appreciate, I can tell that you have done a deep dive into us, Smash, and you are so well prepared, and I'm appreciating these thoughtful questions. That's the shout out. We do that.
But there's lots of research that proves gratitude practice is really transformative for being open and ready to healthy relationships and experience. So I think what you named is really documented and evidence-based.
Yeah.
we've been thrown around the sort of family metaphor. This sounds a lot better than most families I know. I mean, you know, like if every family had like a carefully cultivated community, like, you know.
You know, we bicker like.
Sure.
Like Masa, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When push comes to shove, you're a family. Yeah.
But yeah, I think, Malaika, what you said when I was there was a more pointed version of what you just said, which is like people only leave here when they get pregnant or die.
Oh my gosh, I was trying to not.
So, sorry. In a sense, like, yes, there's onboarding now because the school's getting bigger. But I think the real magic is people stay because it's the kind of community, you know, who wouldn't want to be part of a community where there's gratitude, where students are respectful, where you're working in collaboration with your peers. Jessica, I think you told me that you have a one-on-one with each faculty member once every 3 weeks for 45 minutes, like, you know, in a place where you're really known and respected. If we compare that to the landscape out there and the way that the teaching profession is kind of hemorrhaging right now, you know, if we built more communities like this, more people would want to stay. People not only leave schools to go to other schools, people leave schools to take on totally other types of jobs. So if more environments were like this, more people would stay in the sector as a whole.
Agreed.
I'd like to go back to link this point back to something that you talked about earlier, which was the fact that Smash has been around for 52 years. It's a known quantity, you know, had the same kind of approach for that period of time. You've clumped kids in the same kind of manner, and yet your neighboring schools aren't necessarily doing that. So my question is, if you care to answer it, and you may not, what kind of influence do you think you've had on the schools around you by being long-term, consistent? You're not just a flash in the pan, here's something new and cool, and then it's gone 5 years later. What kind of influence have you had on the schools around you as they look at the fact that you don't have trouble retaining teachers, that you don't have the same kinds of discipline issues, you have different relationships with your parents, perhaps more positive relationships than often is the case in schools? What kind of influence have you had on the schools around you?
First, I would say that there are lots of examples in our own district of people doing looping or really honoring like a whole process into project-based learning. But I think what you're speaking to is whether the entire school is doing it, like kind of collective teacher efficacy or collective staff efficacy is how I'm sort of hearing your question. And when Jal visited Smash, we talked about the difference between being a public school of choice for our district and being like a neighborhood, the community school. And so part of what has been, I think, a lack of traction, not attraction, but traction, has been this thought that, well, when people opt in, they can have that. But if you're just serving everyone in the neighborhood, would it really work? And we are about to undergo a transition.
Right.
Our school board has directed us that we are going to become the neighborhood school next year, and that's how we'll grow over the next several years to be two groups per grade level with neighborhood priority. And I'd like to hear from both of you, Jal and Rod, about what's the qualitative and quantitative data I can collect to help, because it's been easy to sort of, oh, that's nice, but you're not serving a community population.
Right.
Hmm. So now we're going to be, and I have every confidence that we're going to be just as beautiful in those relationships with students. So what do you two think would be meaningful? I don't even like the word data, but like data to collect to try to help compel others that this is viable.
Yeah.
In a public school, that's a neighborhood public school.
That's such a Jal question.
Oh, man. I mean, I think one interesting dimension for that you all have been thinking about, but I would love to, you know, check back with you like a year from now, is the size question. I think size really affects everything. It affects the nature of the relationships and how well people know each other. And I think it will be really interesting to see, like, just in my own practice, for example, I taught a class on deeper learning one of the first years I was at the Ed School, and it went great, which for a first time out is not to be expected necessarily. And then students read the evaluations. And then the next year, you know, we went from like 33 to like 53. And then the second year, it wasn't so great, even though we did like roughly the same things we did in the first year. So then I just like split it in half. I was just like, okay, we'll just have a section in the morning and a section in the afternoon. And then we were down to 25 and it was great again. But, you know, I have some colleagues who can run classes with 100 or 140 people in it, and they build all of these micro communities, and each micro community has a purpose, and then the micro communities cross. And then one woman, Karen Brennan, like literally like sits down with every one of her 150 students for 20 minutes to like have a conversation about their project and their future and things like that. And she just like blocks a week where she just like sits down with 150 students back to back. I guess what I'm saying is she's able to build the same kind of community with 150 that I thus far have only really built with 25, but only through really like thoughtful, intentional effort. So one thing I'm just be really curious about is, as your school gets bigger, what the sort of structures are that allow you to do some similar things with twice as many students.
Wise words. I have none. You talk about data, and we know that includes evidence. So I love the term evidence better than data. Of, you know, you've got student videos, you've got collections of things that help explain and articulate what your school is about. And I think those can be super, super powerful. Kids are better ambassadors than any adults. And the other thing that I've learned, and I have scar tissue to prove it, is, you know, going to a group of parents, and we do this provincially when I was in government here, come to a group of parents and say, what is it you would like? They will underline all the things that you may not like to have in your school. Well, I know about letter grades, so I want more of those. I know about these things, so I want more of those things. And they keep articulating the past. You know, the greatest enemy of educational transformation is memory. Talking about the past. Well, when I was in school, we did this. And, you know, so instead of just asking the question, what is it you'd like? Ask, how do you feel about, what is it, what are your dreams for your children? What are, you know, those kinds of things that gets them into the, well, we can do that. And here's how we could do, we can serve those dreams and desires. And here's how we can do that. As opposed to just saying, what do you want? Well, we want more letter grades. Because they're talking about the things that they know and which, you know, are from the past. So I think opportunities for parents to talk and to dream about what they want for their kids, and you are the vehicle for that to happen. And I think they come online.
I guess one other quick thing I'd say is that I think the long-term data would be helpful. So anything you can do about where they go after you and then after that in terms of college and all of that. And also, you know, if it were possible to collect some data from the schools that they go to, from the ninth grade teachers or the principals and so forth, just to sort of more systematically say what you said to us. I feel like we live in this sort of short-term world where everything's test scores and so on and so forth. And so if you're trying to do this more holistic thing, like you're going to produce a human being who can do different things. And so someone who can attest to that might be helpful.
It's interesting. Our 12th graders, right? So 4 years after they leave us, if they're willing to take the time to write a reflection about their high school experience and what did or didn't translate from their SMASH influence into that, then they get a scholarship towards their next step when they leave us. And they can say as positive or negative as I want. It's just, do they take the time to reflect upon like SMASH's influence and how that played out in their high school experience? So we have that from all, from forever. And in school tours, I put those binders out for incoming parents, prospective parents, to like look through if they want to. And you're right, that does have value. Not just looking at what the current students who are leading the tour are saying, but, you know, you're 4 years out from here. What do you have to say? And then the other thing that we love is that just like so many schools have where the 12th graders come back and they do a clap out, you know, in their cap and gown. But for us, we take them through every classroom and they answer different questions in each classroom. So they just did this on Monday. What's your best advice as these young people are going to think about high school in the future? You know, what made the biggest imprint on you in these experiences in high school? Or where, what are you excited about your next step? You know, we ask different questions in each room just to keep it fresh for them. But I never videotape it. Because I'm really so in the moment every year with them. Yeah. These are human beings we raise. We're so excited to hear from them. But might be good to also capture that for other people's information.
Okay, write that down. That's a great idea.
Thank you very much, Jessica Malaika, for your thoughtful, thought-provoking conversation with us. Sounds like we have a date about a year from now to come back and sort of see how things have iterated, which would be quite brilliant. You've given us lots to think about. However, that part of the program is over. Now we're going to the short snappers, the lightning round. Our producer, Gino Beniamino, has joined us again, the holder of the questions that Jal nor I have seen. And so we will try to answer them along with you. So again, thank you very much. And Gino, over to you, my friend. I hope it's a hockey-related question because there was a great game last night.
I was wondering how long it was going to take you to remind us of that. Well, Jessica and Malaika, welcome to our free-range questions segment of this season's Lightning Round. And I had started the season with approximately 30 questions. That list is now down to 8 random questions that are left on our list. So we will go right ahead here and generate the first one out of our virtual hat. Looks like question number 2. Oh, this, hey, you asked for sports, Rod. You got it. So I'm going to start with you, Jessica. What is your favorite sports team?
Okay, you're not going to like this answer because I have 2 sons that have done marching band for all 4 years and they've lettered in it. So it's actually, you won't accept it, but I accept that the Vikings marching band is a sports team.
I will fully accept that. My wife actually did marching band her freshman year of college. So I'm there with you on that. Malaika, how about you?
Let's see. I am oddly a Miami Dolphins fan. I'll stick with them, highs and lows. And then without a particular team, my favorite sport is volleyball, all things volleyball.
Have you played volleyball before?
I did, yeah, for many years. Beach volleyball too. So, you know, it's a personal love.
And you coach it.
Oh, and I coach it now. Right, right, right.
Malaika, I'm also a Dolphins fan through thick or thin. At one point, I even had a Dolphins blow-up chair, which I would take out on Sundays, but my wife vetoed that in a move. It didn't quite make it, but still a Dolphins fan.
That's right.
Shout out to the Larry Zonka era, back Bob Greasy and all the gang back there. Yeah,
a little before our time, but yeah.
Before.
Yeah, that's my time. They were wearing leather helmets, though, so that was kind of cool. What would my sports team be? I'm going to go Canucks. Yeah, that's easy. Vancouver Canucks, because next year is the year.
I was going to say, you're not going to jump on the Oilers bandwagon? Always. We're going to go Canucks?
No, I'm tolerating the Oilers, and as a loyal Canadian, I'm behind them. But come next season, they are right towards the bottom of my list of teams that I would ever cheer for.
Oh, I appreciate your sports loyalty.
Yeah.
We'll go quickly to question number 2 here, which is number 8 on my list. And this is, we'll go in reverse order. Rod, do you have a favorite or lucky number?
16. I've worn that in almost every sports. My first year playing football, I was 32 as a tailback. And then I went to 16, and I've been 16 in everything I've played ever since.
All right, Jal, you?
Nice. I'll go with 13. We'll stick with the Dan Marino theme.
It's quite appropriate as we are recording this on Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Oh, good point.
Yeah. Malaika, how about you?
My favorite number, it used to be 3. And then I felt maybe as I grew up, I needed a little more oomph in my favorite number. So now it's 33.
Oh,
I like that.
Okay.
And Jessica, what about you?
My lucky number is 7 because I grew up with grandparents who really liked Las Vegas and they would bet for me and bring me home money when they bet on number 7. So that went my college fund over the year.
Nice. Gina?
Well, you're giving me hope as a part-time poker player then. My kid's college fund through that.
Works both ways, though, I think. Yeah.
Right. In a similar vein, though, my number is kind of related to Vegas, but not in the way that you'd think. And it's 21. My wife and I actually met on the 21st, got engaged on the 21st, and got married on the 21st. Both of our kids' due dates are supposed to be the 21st, although neither one of them cooperated. So 21 is the lucky number in our house. Maybe we have time for one more quick question. That is question number 4. And this is, what is the last movie you saw in a theater? Malika, we'll start with you.
No, I'm not ready for it.
Wow.
I have to be ready in
That's
the life.
That's a very personal question.
I know. I have been, gosh, how embarrassing. Oh, Wicked. I saw Wicked, which I thought I wasn't going to like, but I was way into it. And I brought my godson with me. And even though he was a little scared because he's 10 years old, we left the theater singing our hearts out. So Wicked.
Yeah, part 2 coming out this fall, so get ready. Jessica, and you?
The last movie in the theater was over winter break with my parents and my kids and husband. We saw, and I can't even think of the name of it, the Bob Dylan movie?
I can't think of the name, but was it called Bob Dylan?
No. Oh. And it was great. And, you know, he has a local Santa Monica leadership history as well.
I believe that was called A Complete Unknown.
There you go.
Excellent. And Rod, over to you.
I'm thinking it was It.
The clown movie?
Clown movie, yeah. Big Stephen King fan, yeah. Kind of needed that big screen. But that was a long time ago, so 2017 or something like that. So went to the theater and things had changed because it had been in so long that there was Lazy Boy chairs to sit in. And so I missed the first half of the movie because I was out cold. It's air conditioned. It's quiet. It's dark. I'm going to sleep. So.
Yeah, the Lazy Boy chairs are amazing. I remember also missing the first 10 years of my kids' lives and not going to the theater and then being like, holy crap. So yeah, on the kid theme, the last movie I saw was Lilo and Stitch with my 5-year-old about 2 weeks ago. Gino, how about you?
Well, it's funny because everyone who's saying things, it's so relevant because I have my 2 kids as well. And seeing the giant comfortable chairs and someone who falls asleep very easily, it is difficult for me to go to the movies these days. But I also grew up working in a movie theater, which was a lot of fun. Ooh. But the most recent movie that we saw was the Minecraft movie with the kids. So the Lava Chicken song being sung over and over again in our house. But yes, that was also in one of the Lux theaters and I'm watching it, on my back. But the kids really enjoyed it, and that's really our only reason for going to the theaters these days. All right. Well, another wonderful segment of Free Range Questions. Thank you all for your responses, and back to you guys to close things out.
Thanks, Gino. Jessica, Malika, thank you very much. Really appreciate the conversation. I felt like I'd been visiting your school, and thank you, Joel, for visiting and bringing this story to Free Range Humans.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for the conversation. It's wonderful.
Thank you for your time, and we plan to see you in the year, did we say?
Yeah, Rod and Gino, you come too.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
See you in a year.
All right, sounds good.
This is Rod Allen.
This is John Maida.
And this is Free Range Humans, a place where we consider how to make schools fit for human consumption. Today, we were joined by Jessica Riesch and Malika Boyer, who are principal and 6th grade teacher at Santa Monica Alternative Schoolhouse. Thanks, everyone. Cheers. Mm-hmm.